Welcome. Good evening. Tonight I'd like to bring up a Zen story called Das Sui's Kalpa Fire, or Aeonic Fire, the fire of the that destroys the eon. A story that I've long appreciated. But as a kind of preface to this Zen story, I thought it might be nice to share a story that I just learned about this kalpa business. Like we just chanted, right? And unsurpassed dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Sometimes we translate it as eon. And there's different stories about how long a kalpa is. Like there's stories like you can't even talk about it really in terms of numbers because it's so long in terms of years. But more like in metaphors, we can imagine that there's Mount Everest, you know, solid rock, and a small hummingbird comes by once every 1,000 years, and the wind from its wing, shakes a little dust off of Mount Everest, and it slides down the mountain a little, and then 1,000 years later, another hummingbird comes by and does that. And so the time it takes to wear down Mount Everest to like sea level is one kalpa. Which, it's a poetic way of getting us in the mood for long spans of so-called time. And just to even to contemplate an image like that puts our life in a different perspective, doesn't it? Makes our lifespan of probably 100 years or less seem pretty tiny in the scheme of kalpas. But there's some Buddhist cosmology around how worlds come to be and how many kalpas it takes and so on. And I have heard bits and pieces, but because this Zen story from the Book of Serenity is about the world system that we live in being destroyed by this fire during the kalpa of destruction. I thought, how does this go again, the cosmology? So I looked it up and I thought this was a cool story. And you might think this is like boring old stuff. You can let me know afterwards what you think. But partly I thought it was neat because in Buddhism we usually don't talk about creation myths. Most religions have creation myths. In Buddhism we maybe just say dependent co-arising. Right, is our creation myth. But there are things maybe more akin to classic creation myths in our tradition. And here's one of them. This is the Abhidharma Kosha of Vasubandhu, Bodhisattva. So he's writing in like the 4th century India, but he's not making this up. He's commenting on sutras and older sources, so I don't know exactly where he's pulling this stuff from, but he likes to get it into the full description. So this is a chapter on the world, and it goes into time. So there was just a section here on this kshana, like the smallest moment of time is in the 65 instants. There are 65 of these moments, these kshana moments, the smallest moment of time, there's 65 of them in a time that it takes a healthy person to snap his fingers. So that's about small time, 65 moments in a finger snap, and then Vasubandhu gets into big time, like kalpas. He also, in between, he explains years and months and so on. He says, now we must explain the kalpa, or cosmic period, it's translated here. I think eon is good. And a kalpa of destruction or disappearance of a world system lasts from when no more beings are being born in the hell realms to the destruction of the physical planet. So this is something that, like, I thought, I haven't heard this before. So the story is something like, you know, in part of Buddhist cosmology, there's these different realms, right, of that beings live in. These lower realms we call hell. Like, and you can, as you hear these different realms, you can see how also there are also realms that we all maybe live in sometimes. The hell realms are dominated by anger and hatred and extreme suffering. Maybe we could say they are the extreme suffering arising from anger and hatred, is what hell realms are. And then there's the hungry ghost realms that are realms of great hunger and deprivation arising from dissatisfaction and greed. And then there's the animal realms that we can see in this world, and they're more arising from or related to fear and confusion. And then there's the so-called upper realms of the human realm, where we might be living right now. We might be in a hell realm or hungry ghost realm now, but if we listen to a Dharma talk, it's kind of a general human thing. Human realm, and then there's these deva, celestial deva realms, where they arise from good actions. But they're all conditioned realms. All these realms of samsara arise and cease, and through karmic actions of sentient beings, intentions of sentient beings, there's arising and ceasing, birth and death in these realms. Yeah. And so now Vasubandhu is telling the story of this world system that we live in, and we could see this. Some people say it's this planet. Some people say it's like the solar system, because this is old time. This is like, you know, over 2,000 years ago story. So it doesn't exactly accord with modern science, like most creation myths don't. But as a creation myth, I think it's an interesting one. So in this world system, it starts to disintegrate. It starts to decay, and it's called a kalpa of destruction and decay. When the first hell beings start to disappear, so let's say that seems like a good thing, and actually that's the interesting thing in this story, that this destruction of the world, as you start to hear the story, sounds like not such a bad thing. It starts with beings in the hell realms, beings no longer being born in the hell realms. So they're still continuing to be born in like the animal and human realm. And it sounds like if they're no longer being born in hell realms, that means like things are getting better. There's not so much anger and hatred. It's, at least I would imagine it would be like that. But it's partly just the way this story goes, is that these lower realms are the first thing to disintegrate. And it even has a clause like, well, what about great anger and hatred, where the karmic effect would be a hell realm? What happens to those beings that would be born in hells? And Vasubandhu says, then they're born in hell realm in a different world system. So in this world system, the our hell realm start to empty out, and maybe some other world system, they start to increase, interestingly. And then it goes up from these lower realms, then the hungry ghost realm starts, you know, the beings in the hungry ghost realm, all these realms are realms of birth and death, right? So the hungry ghosts die, and there's no more beings born into the hungry ghost realms. So they empty out. And then it... Vasubandhu says, so too is the destruction of the hungry ghost realm and the animals. The animals that reside in the great ocean disappear first. Those that live with humans on earth, land creatures, will disappear at the same time that humans do. So now I hear this kind of this creation myth as somewhat related to, we might imagine how things might go in this world system according to science too, right? I don't know about the sea creatures going first. I know that a lot of sea creatures are dying out now due to like radiation and things like this, right? I don't know who's going to go first, but we could imagine that a lot of animals on this planet will probably disappear around the same time humans do. And probably some animals will outlive us humans. We can imagine. And then, so now we're up to the human, so the lower realms are kind of like emptied out. We don't really notice that because we don't see the hell beings and the hungry ghosts in the traditional way. But we see the animals dying off along with the humans. And then, so it sounds like things are there's a sort of sense of not so good, like destruction, but then we also see it's just a change, actually. So then here's part of the story. Among the humans of Jambudvipa, this is like on our continent, a person enters by him or herself without a teacher, but just due to suchness itself, into the first dhyana, or the first meditative absorption. And it, for some reason, the story is like, instead of like they're a Buddhist practitioner and they hear how to practice these meditative absorptions, just from the reason of dharmata, or suchness itself, just from the reality of things, somebody, maybe one person, right, naturally enters this meditative concentration. And then, but it's a temporary thing. But it's very sweet, these very present, non-conceptual, meditative absorptions. And coming out of this, she exclaims, happy and joyful is this realm free from attachment. Peaceful is the pleasure and joy that arise from detachment. So, you know, like coming out of sitting this period of this natural period of zazen, so the person says, how wonderful it is to be free from attachment. They just naturally discovered this. And then Vasubandhu says, understanding these words, this exclamation from this person coming out of zazen, other people say, that sounds neat. And they also practice this. And so then after they die, they're born in these deva realms. This is part of the cosmology, part of the story is that deva realms are born from non-attachment and from wholesome actions, and particularly the ones where the devas are really hanging out there, they're kind of from these meditative absorptions. So in the Zen tradition, they sometimes kind of tease the people too attached to meditative absorption and say, you'll just be born in a deva realm and hang out in this some celestial realm, and that's no good for a bodhisattva. You should try to hang around these humans and help them. That's the kind of Zen take. This is kind of pre-Zen. Also, the Buddha said also, the Deva realms are like, they're nice, but it's not Buddhahood. It's not enlightenment. There's samsaric realms of birth and death. Long, long, long life in the Deva realms. But then they come to an end. But in this story, so now that the humans are, it sounds like, naturally learning this peaceful abiding and spreading the word, and when they die, they're no longer born in the human realm, they're born in the Deva realms. So thus, the human realm is emptied out. You see how this is going? From the bottom up, all the realms of birth and death are gradually disappearing, actually. These realms of sentient beings are disappearing. And now there's only the devas left. And then basically the same thing. The devas, due to the natural reason of suchness, the way things are, they also discover these types of meditation, and they move higher up the Deva realms. And then Vasubandhu says, when not a single being remains in these heavenly realms anymore, the destruction of beings is finished, and the world has been destroyed to that extent. So there's still a physical planet, but all the living beings have died, and maybe we could say, if there's karma to exhaust, they've actually that those mind streams have arisen in some other world system. So they've kind of cleared out this planet, and those beings are now like in some other form in another world system, because the law of karma is such that as long as actions, intentional actions, have not come to fruition, they must come to fruition in some form.
No life, nothing.
No life on this planet. On this planet.
What's that? Rivers, lakes?
Well, that's how the story goes now. Yeah, there's no life on this planet. Due to karma, we could say there's life has embodied another planet or inhabited another planet. And then, by reason of the exhaustion of the collective action or karma, which has created the physical world, and by reason of emptiness of the world, this great fire arises. Actually, technically speaking, seven suns. But great fire arises after all the beings have gone, but due to the exhaustion of the collective karma which has created this planet, and by reason of the emptiness of the world, this planet, this fire arises and consumes the world, including the palaces of the celestial beings. And after the fire goes out, then water sweeps through and washes away. After fire, then wind comes through and blows away all the ashes, and then this great flood comes through, and any final remaining ashes are washed away in the flood. So it disappears in various places in the tradition later, this fire, wind, and water, great raging fire, great raging wind, and then great raging flood and water. Destroy this world system. Both the beings and the physical world itself. And you know, we can think of maybe images of, it's not that, you know, the whole world system is not being destroyed, but we do have these days some great raging fires, and we have some great raging winds and hurricanes, and we have some great raging floods, don't we, in the last decades, due to the collective karma of sentient beings, which is what they said, this fire, wind, and water is also due to the collective karma of sentient beings, and then the exhaustion of that karma on this world system, and by reason of the emptiness of the world also, all this can happen. So this destruction through fire, wind, and water, and then the world, which has been destroyed in this way, stays destroyed for a long time. 20 small kalpas. And there is only space where the world once was. So this is what they sometimes call the empty eon. And in Zen, they sometimes use this image from Vasubandhu to say, like, you know, what was your original face like before the empty eon, or like say something from the empty eon, like this. So they kind of playing with this realm of the space that's left. It's not exactly that there's nothing, it's that there's space after this world has been destroyed. Then, as Vasubandhu says, by reason of the collective karma, intentional actions of beings, there appears the first signs of a future physical world. The story is not over. It's just been 20 kalpas of space. And again, I think of, like, you know, this is such a strange myth, but I think modern cosmology and, you know, people looking into how the Big Bang and so on, and that maybe there wasn't just one Big Bang, and that there's universes expand and contract and come into being and so on. It's maybe not so far-fetched. There was a space, and then this is the kind of Buddhist twist on it, is that the new world comes into being due to the collective karma of sentient beings. There appear the first signs of a future physical world. It starts with very light winds arising in space. And so from space there's some wind, and then from wind, fire or heat starts, and then water develops, and then solid earth. And the five elements like this. The physical world is thus created. So now the new world is created to this extent. Then a being, so that we have a physical world with no apparent sentient beings on it in the story. But then a being dying in this other world system is born in the heavenly palace of Brahma in the Deva realms, which is just an empty palace. And then the ones dying one after another in this other world system are reborn in this new world system. Can you follow the story?
It's like a wormhole.
Something like a dharmic wormhole. A karmic wormhole, maybe we'd say. Like a karmic wormhole that all the beings are traveling through. Karma is not exhausted, so it's not like there's no more world systems. The actions must have an effect. Dogen likes to say this too, that all intentional actions, if they don't have an effect in this life, Dogen says, they will in the next one or some other realm. That's the Buddha's teachings. Karma cannot be destroyed or evaporated. Every action must have an effect. So if we don't experience the effect now, someone will later. This is the law of karma. So it appears. So then, from the Deva realms, the human realms start being inhabited on this new world system, and then the animal realm and the hungry ghost realm and the hell realms. And when a being is first born in the hell realms, in this new world system, that's the end of the period of arising of this kalp, of this the kalpa of arising. And then there's these period of 20 small kalpas of just duration, abiding of the world system. And then the destruction starts again. And where is this part? There's a part in here where it gets even more detailed of how the abiding starts turning into the destruction. Basically, like, beings are very happy. It's a little bit like the Garden of Eden, and then they take their food is joy. They eat joy for food. They don't need physical food. In this, things are going along quite nicely. Lifespan is like thousands of years and so on. And then there's some sort of like a liquid on the earth, and it's sweet. And some beings discover this sweet liquid. And they start drinking, like, this is good. And then their friends hear about it and like, this is really good. And then they start getting a little bit greedy about it. And they're like, this is my liquid. I discovered it first. And like, okay, that's your liquid. But this is my liquid over here. And they start setting up boundaries. And this, Vasubandha says, and this is ownership starts. And then some people don't have as much of the liquid as others. And then he says, and then greed starts. And then they start trying to actually fight the other ones to get some of their liquid. And he says, this is where fighting starts. And then it's like, and then people have a lot of liquid. They need people to take care of it. So they like, create these like slaves. And he says, that's where the lower castes originate. Or we might say it's abuse of others and inequality develops. And this is like, and now the whole destruction process is going. I think it's a kind of a neat story. And then at the end of this section, Vasubandhu says, of what does a kalpa consist? This eon, what's it made up of? The kalpa is made up of 5 skandhas. That one just really like shook me at the end of the story. He goes on for volumes, right? Sort of like a Buddhist creation myth, creation and destruction myth. So I just thought, you might not have ever heard this story. I never heard a lot of those pieces. And it rings somewhat true to the, we might say we're in a kind of destruction kalpa now. Things sometimes don't seem so great. Although there's a lot of great stuff happening too. But even back in the 9th century, Zen people were wondering and kind of worried about this fire that comes and consumes the whole world. Fire, wind, and water, and all the beings in the world system disappearing, and then the whole physical world even disappearing. So, case 30 in the Book of Serenity, a monk asks the Zen teacher Da Sui, when the fire at the end of the kalpa, or the fire of the kalpa of destruction, rages through and the whole universe is destroyed. Is this destroyed or not? Dasui said, destroyed! The monk said, then it goes along with that? afterwards, this goes along with the universe that's destroyed? And Dasway said, it goes along with that. Hakuin Zenji, in his comments on this story, says, this pervades the sky above and the earth below. But does it really go along with all these transient, mundane phenomena? It goes along with that is a terrifying saying, Hakuin says. Not only do we lose all beings that we love and appreciate and all life on the planet and the very planet itself, but we also lose this, according to Dasway. But this monk had some doubt about that. He wondered about that. He said, well, okay, but let me go check that out with another Zen teacher. So he went and asked Longji. Same question. When the fire in the kalpa of destruction rages through and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? And Longji said, not destroyed. And the monk said, why is it not destroyed? And Longji said, because it's the same as the universe. I think this is kind of hard to contemplate, but I always like this story because it's really, I think it goes to the heart of our practice. We chant every day, form is not different than emptiness, emptiness is not different from form. It is not, this is not different from the universe is not different from this. Even though this pervades all of space and Tenke Densone, an old Soto teacher commenting on this, says, as for this, each person must see what it is directly. Ultimately, it is not something that's destroyed, nor not destroyed. It's not arising or ceasing. It's not destructible or indestructible, not existent or non-existent. This. So, but if this emptiness itself is form. It's not like emptiness floating around apart from form. Then, when the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? It goes along with that. That's what he said. You can't separate these. That's one perspective. And then another perspective is this destroyed or not? It's not destroyed. Why is it not destroyed? Because it's the same as the universe. Which seems kind of funny, because we'd say, well, the universe was destroyed. So then, why is it not destroyed if it's the same as the universe? But here, I think we could say it's the same as the universe, and the firestorm that's destroying the universe, and the space at the end of the universe, and the next universe, and all of it, right? So this that is all of that, is not destroyed. Right? Yeah? This particular tiny little, you know, one of infinity universes that we live in, this one may be destroyed, but the multiverse of multiverses is not destroyed, because it is the same as all of these universes. And then I really liked, when I first read it, I thought, wouldn't it be better to say, why is it not destroyed? Because it is not the same as the universe. Therefore, when the universe is destroyed, it's not destroyed. I thought that would be, it would be easier to get a hold of that way. And then, because of that, I was kind of happy when Wansong, the ancient commentator on the story, said, one version of this story says, because it isn't the same as the universe. Yes! There's a story that has it saying the opposite. Why is it not destroyed? Because it's not the same as the universe. And then Wansong says, this story is most worthy of consideration. You can say it's the same, or you can say it's not the same as the universe. Adding error to error, neither way is right or wrong. But I do find it interesting to contemplate in the realm of this, have any one of us ever actually experienced the arising of this, or the cessation of this? Has anyone ever had such an experience?
I don't know.
That's a good answer. Well, if this is something that can arise at a certain time, then we're talking about the phenomenal world of arising and ceasing things. Yeah? And if we've experienced the ceasing of this, then we could say, is it really this? Or is it just some manifestation, some appearance of something that looks like this? I'm talking about capital T.
Right. So
this.
Just the duality of small t and capital T.
Yeah, or the non-duality of small t and capital T. Depending on, you know, whether it goes along with that or not. Yeah. But this capital T, this that we can't actually name, right, but that we are living in, and we have always been living in, and is shiningly enjoying itself even during the kalpa of where nothing's happening, the kalpa where there's just space between world systems. If this is just enjoying itself, you know, happily, at such a time, then how could it be something that arises for us or ceases for us? That's why I would propose that actually I would propose that it actually is impossible for any of us, or any even deva celestial beings, to experience a beginning or a birth of this. or an end, like a death of this. And if we did, I would propose, that's not exactly this, capital T, because how could this be born and die? So if we experience like an ending of something, we could even take a step back and say, well, what is it that experienced this beginning or end? There must be something that experiences a beginning or end. And is that which experiences the beginning or end? Have we ever experienced it beginning or ending? And if we did, we have to take a step back further and say, well, who experienced this beginning or end? And at some point, if we step back far enough, there's one who doesn't begin or end, that is not destroyed at the end of the kalpa. And yet, destroyed. Mm-hmm. Yes.
What did Hakuin say?
Haku.
It's not a story in the whole world.
Well,
that part?
He was commenting. It was the first commentary that you read.
Yeah, well, first he said this, talking about this, it pervades the heavens above and the earth below. And he says, does it go along with transient mundane phenomena? Is his question to us. Does it, the ultimate, unnameable, unspeakable Buddha Dharma, go along with transient, impermanent, mundane phenomena of this world? Therefore, it goes along with that is a terrifying saying.
What do you think he means by that?
Well, right after he said, this is a terrifying saying, he says, but the Buddhas and ancestors appreciate it.
But why do you think he says it's terrifying?
I think because then what can we take refuge in?
Control.
What can we take refuge in? What's that?
What can we control? What can we understand? We're lost. We have to come up with our own.
Yeah, I think we're all looking for, and you could say maybe this is the origin of all religions, is we're looking for a refuge in the midst of this crazy, painful world of birth and death, of arising and ceasing, of impermanence. We're looking for actually an ultimate refuge that actually is reliable. And we might say, some might say, well, just impermanence itself is my refuge. But how do we take refuge in that, if that's so, right? I'd say, is that really, do we really feel total security in impermanence? And maybe if we do, then I would say that's the one that goes along with it. But if we're more like, how could there be refuge in, as Hakuin says, transient mundane phenomena? That's why if it goes along with all this transient mundane phenomena, that could be terrifying because we want something. Therefore, Buddha offers teachings like, in the early teachings, Buddha even said, like, there is an unborn, undying, unconditioned, unmade. If there were not an unborn, undying, unconditioned, unfabricated, unconstructed, then liberation from the born, the dying, the constructed, the fabricated would not be possible. So we hear things like that and then we feel like that is a refuge, the unborn. And as long as we don't make it into something, because if we make it even slightly into something, then it becomes born. That becomes a born thing. Yes?
So that's why I was just talking about Dogen's not knowing his most intimate, which is the alternative to being the most terrifying. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And you have the choice to go that hero's journey, which is accept our inability to know and to move ahead and say, I'll play. But I do. How does that relate to this?
I think that's just the Hindu version of the same.
Because I've heard those, I've actually looped it up, and they're shorter, they're like 2,500 years, and they're going to end in 2025, and Maitreya is going to come.
Oh, yeah, there's other stories. Whether that's, I think the thing about Maitreya and all, that's more about the Dharma also has this period of arising, abiding, ceasing, destruction, and no Dharma. So that has a shorter time period than the whole world system.
Yeah,
this Vasubandhu's got some great stories in here too about how Buddhas fit into this whole picture and Bodhisattvas, and but you could say I think Vasubandhu says, he's like, when did the Buddhas appear? They don't appear at the beginning stages of the arising of the Kalpa, when lifespan is thousands of years and beings are taking joy for food. When the Buddhas start to get greedy, when the beings start to get greedy about the liquid, and did I mention that the liquid turns solid at some point? It turns solid.
That's what happens.
It congeals and it's like a crust on the surface of the earth, but it's delicious and And he says, when that's happening, that's when the Buddhas come into this world system and like, you guys need help. Like Superman, kind of like coming in. But I think this point of refuge is an interesting one, and I don't know how people think of refuge in Buddha, then there's refuge in Sangha too. We could just conflate them all into one, but we also say things like homage to Prajnaparamita, the lovely, the holy, the perfection of wisdom, of this gives light, unstained, the entire world of transient mundane phenomena cannot stain her. There is a possible refuge. And I think that's how I think of practices, that we're our vow is to become more and more intimate with our ultimate refuge, so that we can play in the realm of birth and death like a playground. In Soto Zen, it's sometimes said, bodhisattvas see this, the world of birth and death and great suffering as a playground where it can help others. In fact, Vasubandhu, this is usually considered this is Vasubandhu's pre-Mahayana phase, but I'm like, wow, there's some great Mahayana Dharma in this Abhidharma Kosha, where he's saying that Vasubandhu says, why do bodhisattvas, once they have undertaken the resolution to realize supreme awakening, take such a long time to realize it? And he says, because supreme bodhi, awakening, is very difficult to realize. One needs a great accumulation of merit and knowing or awareness, and of innumerable heroic works in the course of three countless kalpas. It's the classic story is the bodhisattva path to Buddhahood is three asamkhyeya kalpas. And Vasubandhu says, one would understand that the bodhisattva searches out this awakening so difficult to attain if this awakening were the only means of arising at liberation. But it's not the case. Why then do they undertake this infinite labor? And I wonder, it's not the case? And I think it's probably says somewhere, but I think what he probably means by it's not the case is you can realize liberation without becoming a Buddha. That's the early path, foundational Buddhism. Like an arhat is completely liberated from suffering, but they're not a bodhisattva or a Buddha. So why, Vasubandhu says, do these bodhisattvas undertake this infinite labor, innumerable labors? He says, for the good of others, because they want to become capable of pulling others out of the great flood of suffering. But what personal good do they find in the good of others? The good of others is their own good, because they desire it. And he talks about this, how they have to realize that there is no personal self in order to do this work of bodhisattvas. So he goes into that, the so-called pretended self they use. They no longer consider the five skandhas as me or mine. This body and mind are not me and mine. And therefore, they increase compassionate wish to benefit others and are ready to suffer 1,000 pains because of this great patience and realization of no personal self. Then Vasubandhu says, in a few words, there's a certain kind of people who, indifferent to what concerns them personally, are happy through the well-being of others and are unhappy through the suffering of others. For them, to be useful to others is to be useful to themselves. These are the bodhisattvas who have no problem spending 3 asamkhya kalpas on the path to realizing this completely beneficial Buddha body. So something I think it's a great koan to contemplate that, and how these two different teachers are both right. When the great raging fire comes to, in the kalpa of destruction and the whole universe is destroyed, is this destroyed or not? You can say, destroyed. Which is a little bit like, and the commentary mentions it a little bit, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? All beings have Buddha nature. So does a dog have Buddha nature? No, Jiaozhou says. It's a little bit like that, the commentary says. It's not that dogs don't have Buddha nature. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not have Buddha nature? Or have Buddha nature or not have Buddha nature? Or have Buddha nature or not have Buddha nature? Or have Buddha nature? No! Is the kalpa destroyed or not destroyed or destroyed or not destroyed or not destroyed? Destroyed! And then a more mild-mannered teacher later, he asks the same question. Is the universe destroyed or not? No. I mean, is this destroyed or not? No. It's not destroyed. That's the gentle approach. It's not destroyed. Because it is everything. It is the totality of everything. It's just space and time. How can totality be destroyed? Even if it's just space, just planetless, starless, chocolateless space, how could this ever be destroyed? May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.